So welcome everyone to our meditation group discussion. I did, as you have copies, that will be online, the copy of what I've handed out today, sort of a summary of what I'll be talking about. So tonight we're on Module 4, Class 9. So we've been teaching this topic of the Four Noble Truths for nine. This will be the ninth session, and will be the last night for the Four Noble Truths. As you know, we've been working with this the book that's online by Punlop Rinpoche, and we've been just using the first two chapters and supplementing it with other material. So we'll be using that, I believe, for the next module on. It'll be something like working with emotions or something. And that's what those two chapters are. And we'll also supplement it with other material. So tonight we also put online the Eightfold Path, which is from The Myth of Freedom and the Way of Meditation by Trungpa Rinpoche. This book here, which is an excellent book, actually. So these sources... you can look up online and see if you want to, you know, purchase them or ask us, and we can help you with ideas. Oh, yeah. This is an old, right? Yeah, content's the same. And Michael's really a good resource, too, for materials and books. He's able to get things for us. So just to review, we started with, actually, some general teachings about how to study and... the importance of study and relationship to study and meditation. Both are complementary and work together. And then we talked about the truth of suffering and the cause of suffering. And last week, Michael Fagan talked about the cessation of suffering.
By the way, just I will have a urgent presentation for people's sanity in case they felt it was a little too much or too complex. Posted sometime in the next 2 weeks in case anybody wants to go back. I've been unfortunately very busy, but it might help in case anybody wants to see, like I did before, where they had a printout.
So an outline.
That and sort of understand how it all works.
Okay, that's helpful. And again, just always keep looking at the website for things that we add, because we do keep adding things as we go along. And we add sometimes material for the classes sort of late, just depends. So tonight is about the path that is the cause for cessation of suffering. So a good way to begin, and we have told this story before, but we always have some new people, so is to look at the life of the Buddha as an example of someone who decided to step onto this path. And as we know, he lived as a prince in a palace, and he had a lot of luxury and indulgence in his life. But there was something in him that made him want to go beyond the walls of the palace, and a curiosity about what was out in the world. And so he escaped, you could say. And what he saw on his journey outside the walls of the palace was the fact of birth, old age, sickness, and death. And that was very shocking to him, having been, you could say, protected from the truth of suffering. So he experienced the intensity of the truth of suffering. It was a great shock. But that process was one that opened his heart, and he realized he wasn't satisfied with just living in the palace the way he had been after having experienced and seen this, what life was for other people. So he wasn't looking for any kind of personal achievement or fixer-upper of his own life, but his concern was for all sentient beings. So for all people, he saw that people went through this process in their life, and he vowed and made a determined effort for himself to actually find out what the cause of that suffering was so that he could help to liberate sentient beings. So his process was one of studying with a lot of yogic teachers in India at that time. There were many different teachers and different lineages and styles, and he studied all sorts of things. One path he studied was asceticism, where he ate very little, basically starved himself. And he came to the point of realization that that wasn't going to be too beneficial if he died from starvation. There's no way he could reach enlightenment or help anybody. So he did take food and regained his strength. And then he proceeded to go to this place in Bodh Gaya in India, where actually there's a great stupa and a shrine and a place where they say that the Buddha attained enlightenment. Who knows? But it's a nice seat. And so there's a tree there called the Bodhi tree, which is apparently a descendant of the original one, so to speak. So he sat under that tree and attained enlightenment. So that is just one example, and we may think, well, he had a pretty good life. Why did he bother doing anything beyond that? But I think that is really the fundamental question. What is it that we are looking for? And even though our life may be fairly comfortable, and certainly the world we live in the United States, is extremely comfortable compared to other places in the world that are suffering with war and disasters more than we have experienced. But at the same time, if we just stop and look, and as we've been studying, we do have various levels of suffering that we experience. And the question comes up all the time, well, what is this life all about? And what? How am I in this life? And what is my purpose and what can I do? So we talk about the path, and that's the topic tonight, which is the path of awakening. And when we say the path, it sounds like it's something laid out, and all you have to do is get on the road and start walking or something. But actually, that's quite a misnomer. You could say it's the non-existent path that you make for yourself after following examples of people that seem to know what they're doing.
You're a non-self.
You're non-self, right. Well, then yes, you know which path to walk on if you're already a non-self, the non-existent path. it does sound like it's mapped out for us, but it's really not like that at all. I have a note here. It's more like a jungle with obscure paths. And I think Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche refers to it as a jungle. And in other words, it's kind of overgrown path and difficult to find. So we each have to make our own path. And that's important to know, that each person's journey is unique. So in Buddhism, we see the Buddha as an example of someone who awakened from confusion, and that we all have that same potential. So that's what we talk about when we talk about Buddha nature, is our fundamental nature. Our fundamental nature is awake, but covered over or confused by our emotional upheavals and sense of solidification of self. So when I was preparing for this talk, I studied and read a lot of different teachings by the Buddha. And Linda, you'll be pleased that I didn't bring in all these these hundreds of lists. But I wrote them down just for you. this is what I wrote and looked for and found. So there's different ways of kind of exploring this topic of path. And you could say one is to look at the 10 unvirtuous actions and the 10 meritorious actions. So that would be like lying and stealing and, you know, basically doing bad things, and the opposite of that. And the 7 characteristics of a dharmic person, also very relevant.
There are only 7.
There are only seven. We could add to them.
We could actually post references for them.
Yes, exactly.
That way, in case you want to follow up on any of these things.
Right.
I mean, the 10 unvirtuous actions and the 10 meritorious actions, so they come together. But they're actually very interesting because they have to do with heart, speech, and mind.
Okay. So I'll work it out.
And there's a number of good teachings on that.
Yes. So the point here is, what I'm giving you, I shouldn't be so facetious, but what I'm giving you here are some key words and possibility of going further in different aspects of the path. However, I won't go into all of these. You'll be happy, or not. And the 5 paths and the 10 bhumis, that is a very traditional way of talking about the path in relationship to the 4 Noble Truths.
What's a
bhumi? The stages.
A bhumi,
a level.
It's like this is actually, the bhumis don't start until you go into the Mahayana, and it's stages of bodhisattva practice.
Right. So this comes later.
Yeah, so this is much more kind of like after we've gotten through the eye of the needle first.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we go there.
We can expand further. So, and then the Eightfold Path, which we posted the reading from The Myth of Freedom, and that's what I'll be talking about tonight. So what happened is, I'm thinking about, well, what do I talk about? You know, is this list good or should I do this? And I actually, I wasn't sure what to do. And then I pulled out this magazine from the UU World, which there was an article here on Selma, Alabama, Selma's Challenge. And I found this very powerful in thinking also about path and how people actually step on a path for themselves in terms of the direction they take in their life. So I wanted to share this with you before we get into more details of the Buddhist Eightfold Path. In the early hours of Monday, March 8th, 1965, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. dispatched a telegram that read, "In the vicious maltreatment of defenseless citizens of Selma, where old women and young children were gassed and clubbed at random, we have witnessed an eruption of the disease of racism, which seeks to destroy all of America. No American is without responsibility. All are involved in the sorrow that rises from Selma to contaminate every crevice of our national life. The people of Selma will struggle on for the soul of the nation, but it is fitting that all America help to bear the burden. I call, therefore, on clergy of all faiths, representative of every part of the country, to join me for a minister's march to Montgomery on Tuesday morning, March 9. In this way, all America will testify to the fact that the struggle in Selma is for the survival of democracy everywhere in our land." And then it goes on to talk about this call that went out all over the country for people to come to Selma, and that there was a minister right here in Boston, worked in Roxbury, Reverend James Reeve, and he ended up going to Selma, and he was killed when he went there. So what I find so powerful about this is that there was something that every person that went there, and they came from all over, and they were not just, you know, they were not just Christian ministers, but rabbis, people from all backgrounds, went to Alabama to bear witness to their belief that this was wrong, the way people were being treated. And what was happening there, I think, also is that people were driven by this larger motivation than their own self-interest. So this Reverend Reeve actually had 4 young children. One was a baby, and his wife didn't want him to go, and he went. And this was true of many other of these people that went, who were also putting themselves, they were putting their lives on the line. So the interesting thing, this happened 50 years ago. And what was interesting in this article was 20 years ago, that was in March 1945, was the end of World War II. And that actually, this writer talked about that being actually something that influenced people to make this decision, to actually step forward and say something. So I'll read this little section because I think it's really interesting to link these things together in terms of the path and how it affected people and what they chose to do. ABC had interrupted the Sunday, March 7th, 1965 broadcast of Judgment at Nuremberg, a drama about the war crime trials in Nazi Germany, to cut to footage of the vicious attack by Alabama state troopers and local vigilantes on 600 black citizens of Selma, Alabama. The connection couldn't be missed. And then I'm skipping down a little bit here. In March 1965, the 20th anniversary of the end of the Second World War was at hand. The trauma of the war years, having touched nearly every adult, was easily evoked. Most remembered the sacrifices made, and many were aware of the consequences of inaction in the face of tyranny. Only in this sense, only in this context, does what happened in Selma make sense. Isn't that interesting? You know, that these things came together at the same time, that actually then people were rethinking and seeing what happened in Germany and how the Nazis got to power, and people weren't speaking up. So they were making that connection, and people went to Selma. So what the connection is here in terms of path is realizing that there's really no self. There's no separation between self and other. And when people make that leap, then they actually, I guess it, you could say it propels them on a certain path. And it also has to do with going into fear or going beyond, you could say, personal protection in some way. Like going beyond, like being willing to step out further. And we know other examples of this, people rescuing people from fires or whatever at the cost of their own, possibility of cost of their own life. They don't even think of it. So just as you could say the Buddha stepped into a situation which was uncharted waters, that there's something that in terms of an inner possibility that I think we have of actually stepping onto a path that is beyond self-protection or self-aggrandizement. And it's actually seeing beyond that to being able to extend yourself to others. So I'm going here beyond what we think of is self-liberation, which is the path that we've been studying, and looking a little further out than that. So as I looked at all these different lists, I thought, what is the common theme here? And what is it that actually connects all of these teachings and has to do with path? And what I came to was the word courage. That actually when we meditate, we're taking a very noble posture. I think, you know, we talked about that in terms of the beginning of the path. And we're also, we're also having the courage to look at our thoughts and let go of them and come back to the breath. So on a very simple level, that takes discipline, but also courage. It takes courage to be willing to look at our own mind to be willing to spend time, to set aside that time and to do it, and to stick to the path. It takes a lot of courage, actually, to stick to the path, because it's very easy to get distracted and thrown off. And a lot of the teachings in these different lists, if you look them up, are about simplicity and giving up, you could say, a lot of extraneous things that don't benefit us. So courage, and obviously the root of that word is the French word cœur, C-O-E-U-R. C-O-E-U-R, I think, cœur.
Comes from Latin, C-O-R.
Latin, cœur. Oh, cœur, right.
Heart.
Heart, the heart. So courage is comes from the heart. So it's courage to go beyond personal fear, and it can be on many levels. I mean, I've given a kind of extreme example of going to Selma and a very day-to-day example of just for all of us as we make a choice whether or not to sit on the cushion and meditate and whether or not to stay there even for the amount of time we thought we were going to do it and whether or not we're going to let our mind just wander or whether we're actually going to apply discipline and come back to the breath. So I have this, I don't know, my notes are slightly different at yours probably, but I have. We have to start where we are. It takes courage to travel on the path of awakening. So what is the path to individual liberation? Basically, within the reading we had from Pumlok Rinpoche, he talks about two main points. One is refraining from doing what causes suffering for oneself and others. So that's the first one. And the second one is then cultivating the causes that truly bring lasting happiness. So if we think about what we refrain from, maybe we could stop here and sort of digest that and think about what, when we're on the path of meditation, what is it that we're refraining from?
Things, I mean, it seems like the thing with the skandhas where we notice, like, we're reacting to stuff and we notice and stop ourselves from taking action based on, like, oh, I notice I'm thinking negatively about this person. Oh, that's just the thought. I don't have to then do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, so we're refraining from going further down that path that we might habitually be inclined to go on, and we're stopping that activity. That's the cessation. Yes?
But it's not refraining from thinking. It's not refraining from thought.
Refraining from thought.
That point that you're saying where you just recognizing it. And I've been thinking that I like this meditating over a long period of time every day. It's really teaching me a lot about myself. At this point, I still think it takes courage just to sit down and know those thoughts are going to come at me and deal with it. It's not so much the courage to not think about them, but to face them. Mm-hmm. Seems to me right now is personally a huge challenge. There's something about that. But, oh, no, that kind of thinking again? Or, oh, no. Still doing that.
But that's where kindness,
that to me is asking me to be courageous to face that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also then the next step of that is Maitri, that kindness to yourself, knowing that the thoughts are going to come, you're still willing to do your meditation practice, and then over time, just be very kind with yourself. These thoughts arise. And knowing that this is the path, this is what happens. And it happens to everybody. And people think there's something wrong with me because I think shamatha is supposed to be peaceful, abiding. And I am not peaceful, so what's wrong? So that's actually maybe a misnomer. Maybe we should call it. The truth is really a lot of confusion.
So the statement, though, to me about the courage to be who we are right now, the question is, who is that who?
And you don't know.
No. Right, I don't. Oh, how did you know that? That's right. So I'm a little confused. But yeah, I don't know. Right.
Do you want to say more about that, Michael?
Yeah, it's the courage to enter don't know. To go beyond, well, I know that I'm this person, that I behave this way, I have this ethical standard, I belong to this tribe, whatever. I have this reputation. Instead, to go into don't know.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Don't know.
Yeah.
Dropping concept.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's actually stripping naked. And stripping naked means you, when you realize that you can just see the thought and drop it by coming to your breath, going to your out-breath. It means you're giving up on that kind of just being the thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it always comes back again.
Well, old habits die hard. Right. No, we're talking about things that have been rooted for, who knows, if you want to take the idea of reincarnation, which is a possibility, it's not a dogma, but then you understand that the way it's been taught is it's been cultivated over eons of just continuous. So we talked about the skandhas,
right,
endlessly repeating itself, and it's just a program we have.
Yeah.
It's inbuilt in us. That's the system. But are we the system? Is that what really we are? I am, or you are? So this is what we're learning about what ego is by learning about what we aren't. You know, we actually begin to realize, okay, if I can drop this, what's actually there?
Yeah, right.
And that's actually the real journey. So the journey has to be involved
right.
in seeing those thoughts.
Yeah.
It has to be witnessing them surface again and again, like waves on an ocean. Here we come, the tides, high tide.
I'm drowning. Maybe that could be the underlying little repetition. But then there's eventually, and sometimes there's more space within those thoughts and a little bit more possibility of just resting in between. So I think you just keep working the process. That's it. It's, you know, it's the path without a goal, really. It's that path. You just keep doing it.
And I think there's that piece of where you start being like, these are just these thoughts that keep coming around.
Right.
And stop being, I think that a piece of the not-self is letting go of, like, I'm the person who always has these thoughts, and that's who I am. And you're just like, there's just these thoughts.
Yeah, very good.
Maybe at some point, you know, if I keep looking, at some point, I'll be like, you know, it's like a book you keep trying to read, and then you're like, you know, I don't even like this book.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Like, I'm just going to return it to the library.
Right.
Or the idea of the one of the early teachings I encountered when I was learning meditation was a statement, thoughts create the thinker.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh.
Right.
You know, the thoughts are just swarming around, right? And then somebody's thinking, well, I must be thinking, and I'm pulling my Cartesian number, you know. It's thinking, therefore it must be me who's thinking it, therefore I am, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when we just begin to sit and witness thoughts as thoughts, we realize, the thoughts are just being, they're just surfacing like this kind of, and who's the thinker? We can't find the thinker. That's why it's really important to always look and be willing to pay attention to that, so that the whole thing gets weakened in terms of its hold on you. Michael described that nicely as hijacking. Our fundamental true nature is hijacked constantly by neuroses.
Yeah, Janet.
It's a little bit of an aside, but what is the? Is there any good purpose to the ego? It usually there's two sides to
right,
a lot of things,
right.
But what good does it serve in our lives? I was just thinking of that today.
Yeah.
I just wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I think it depends whether you're talking about it through psychology, and you need, we've talked about this quite a while back, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, just that I was a person who didn't have much of a sense of self, and really had to struggle to feel that I existed and had a right to breathe the air, so I really needed psychology, and this is really different than when I first heard this. Like,
right.
Now they're going to tell me I don't exist again.
Right. But it's not that, exactly. So that's
the
right, giving dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, it allows me to talk to people and function instead of hide in the corner.
Right, right.
Sort of. So psychologically, mm-hmm. I really need the ego. I don't know if I'm
that's
still
correct.
Supposed to,
right.
If I don't, I mean, I'm not functional in the world.
Right, that's the relative truth, that you need to be functional in the world, so you have to know that you're crossing the street, right, and or you get hit by a car. So there has to be some level of that, but now what we're teaching here is much deeper truth than that, okay? Mm-hmm. So it can be very confusing, and that's why we're going to come at it around, and we're going to come at it many different times. So this fall is really introductory teachings mm-hmm. to, these are foundational teachings. And then we're going to work at it from, we're going to come from the point of view of the emotions. That's the next section. Because we can relate to that. How are we going to figure out what non-self is, really, tell you the truth? It's really tough to understand that. But you can come at it in different ways. So coming at it with working on the emotions is a much easier approach, and we're gonna hit that next. That's where we're going. Okay. Yes.
And just one comment: the ego may serve an evolutionary purpose. It's not one that makes us very happy, because it may be in whatever forces drive evolution may be interested in creating an entity that wants things, that wants to appropriate resources, that wants to be greedy, and so on. Just maybe incompatible with kind of our own happiness.
But apparently,
so we aren't. We have to promise you in our teachings that we're not driving in the direction of either nihilism or being dysfunctional. You have to trust us a little bit about that. And so, it's not, the problem isn't that we have this machinery in us that does what you just said, which is evolutionary machinery, and you can see it in psychology. It's not a problem. The problem is the story we tell about it, the invention after the fact that we exist that comes in, the hijacking. So we're trying to get to see that. We're not trying to dismantle our reflexes or functionality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to be more functional.
I'm really glad you brought that up. Yeah. That's very important. So you should always say that.
Yeah. So then, yes, Harry.
If I could share something that I seem to encounter along these lines that helps me is kind of a skill or a habit. It also leads to a state, and that's the skill like in preparing for these meetings about the non-self. The technique that I think is helpful to me is to always question assumptions. I know in some of the readings they talked about what's the difference between a casual street language of some word and what's a technical meaning of it. But to break the circle of being like non-open or to break the circle of being rigid, the sort of endless reservation is to try to find the assumption below a thought. Mm-hmm. What's leading up to the thought, which is a construct? So there has to be some sort of assertion to create a construct. And the thing that I feel that often leads me to is a state of a challenge of tolerating ambiguity. In other words,
that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
To constantly, it's amazing how many assumptions exist according to our way of living, each person's way of living, that all of a sudden, I don't know what my assumptions are.
Mm-hmm.
And then, or if I let go of this assumption, my life would be chaotic or anarchistic, or whatever you said. And then I'm left with a state which is a condition of ambiguity. That's to be tolerated. You know, that the non-self, I feel, is the great state of ambiguity. So anyway, that's so
good,
two
you.
Things I found on this path. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then what do we cultivate? We talked about what we refrain from, but what do we cultivate, and what are the causes that bring happiness?
Again, to me, in terms of psychology, a lot of us probably have that. And to me, it's self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. In other words, what is the universe? Where are we going? Are we going anywhere? Can I accept myself as to be a part of the universe, to be aligned with it? That gives me happiness. If I would call it a word.
And maybe a sense of appreciation, too, which is can be very simple and is free. Sense of appreciation for very small things. But also, we can move on actually to the Eightfold Path, because this gives more details. So how do we travel on this path, and what might be some pointers that were given in the past? And the Eightfold Path, by the way, many times you might see a symbol of something that looks like a wheel for Buddhism. Sometimes they use a symbol, and it might have eight spokes, almost like a ship's. There's one in this room here. There's like symbols from all the religions, and I'm pretty sure there's a wheel on the Buddhist one. And often that symbolizes the Eightfold Path. So that's just something an aside.
Something called the Dharma Chakra.
Dharma Chakra.
Chakra's wheel. Wheel of Dharma. Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with turning the wheel of Dharma means requesting the teacher to teach, and that image of turning the wheel is used for teaching Buddhism. So the other book I was using, I'm using two books for these comments, and I just gave you what I wrote from my notes. This book called The Compass of Zen by Zen Master Sung San, who taught in Providence, Rhode Island, and Michael actually knew him and studied with him a long time ago. And the other book is the book that you had, The Myth of Freedom. So the first set of comments on each one is from Sung Song, and the second one is from Trungpa Rinpoche. So first, there's a quote I wrote. The Buddha taught the Eightfold Path for taking away desire, anger, and ignorance, and returning to our true nature. That's from Sung Song. So the first thing to talk about is the meaning of the word right, because these are the Eightfold Path is the right view, the right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So in this case, right is not right versus wrong. Right is means more complete. So there's, you could say, self-sufficient. And the other thing I think Trungpa Rinpoche says, seeing life as it is without crutches. There's a term, Samyaksam Buddha, which means completely awakened Buddha. So that's another application of the word right, because the Sanskrit is Samyak, and that means complete. So if you think of it as complete, then you won't be caught in this right versus wrong. So the first one is right view. And interestingly enough, the right view is holding no view. So there you go with the ambiguity. And no view. And so this is, you can hear this teacher speaking in these words. Put down your thinking and opinions and see this world exactly as it is. Why should we pursue temporary feelings and desires born out of desire, anger, or ignorance? So the way Trungpa Rinpoche describes right view is when you see someone coming towards you, you don't have to label them as friend or enemy. So this labeling process is so instantaneous. So right view is holding no opinion.
Is it sort of like just seeing what's there without, it's not like no view in the sense of not looking.
No, you see.
But not coming into it with like, oh, I know what kind of.
Right, prejudgment. So without prejudging.
It has to do with openness.
Open.
So openness to is seeing really what's important there.
Key word right. In terms of understanding what it means to have no view. You're completely open. You don't have any kind of, you don't have a screen you're about to put up and, mm-hmm. Decide who and what is accepting, who is accepting and rejecting.
Right, yeah.
Could you think of it like, it's hard for me to think of having no view.
Yes.
But not mistaking my view for the truth. So that's how I'm holding it right now.
It's,
that's not going far enough, but it's.
Well, it is hard to imagine, but because it shows the contrast from what we normally do to a much more open way of being. So this is all the path and how to get there. So we usually, right away in any situation, we label it and then we have something fixed that happens right away. I like it, I don't like it. Well, that actually comes next. But that first thing is just, you're labeling something. So you could start to notice that, like what happens in the grocery store, the person who runs, the machine or something. You may not have any view, or you may make an opinion about that person. Just we make opinions all we know things
instantly,
we know things all the time. We make judgments. So this is actually a path to living a more open, non-judgmental life.
I mean, I think in general, it's a really good concept to kind of wrap your arms around and so on and so forth. But sometimes you do that out of security.
Mm-hmm.
You're making that judgment walking down the street, and it's just an assessment about, am I okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I mean, I think this is a good, really great principle or whatever you might call it, but as a female, that's.
Yeah. Being open doesn't mean being naive.
Right.
Okay.
Certainly if you have street smarts, you use them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're actually really seeing what's there. So it's easier to assess that because you're not just caught up with your stuff that you're carrying around. You're actually really seeing the situation out there. It's much easier to then assess what's actually going on.
Yeah.
Okay. So, because sometimes your prejudgments you may think, because you walk down that street so many times that it's fine or whatever. You might come from the other way too.
Right.
Right? Okay. Rather than thinking, oh, I'm in this neighborhood, therefore this could happen to me or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
So you may be falsely secure in a certain situation.
Right.
So it's about being, as Michael said, you're open to actually read the environment, what's coming towards you in a more... really open, gracious way. Yeah. So all of these other things, we often shut down, and that's, through our prejudices. We do it all the time. So that's right view. The next one's right thought or right intention. And that may seem quite similar, but the way Trungpa Rinpoche describes it, I think, is helpful. Having conceptually fixed the person, so that's friend or enemy, now you are ready either to grasp or attack him. So it's sort of the next phase of that solidification. So each level is more solid. So this is not right intention. Right intention is not being inclined toward anything other than what is. Pleasure as it is, pain as it is. And Sun-Song talks about not become attached to any views, not holding our opinion and condition and situation. He calls it keep a before thinking mind. You can hear him speaking actually through the language. A before thinking mind. What would that be?
But people see the movie the Seven Samurai, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the samurai is being hired by a village to protect them.
Yeah.
And he's just asked to walk. He's just invited to walk into this. Is it a barn or something like that? And because he has no preconceptions, he senses that someone's going to jump out and hit him with a stick. Just because he's completely open, he has no conditions. Therefore, his actual sense of taking care of himself is functioning perfectly. No opinions. And this guy comes yelling out with a stick, and the samurai just calmly deflects him. That's having no... That's non-thought.
Before thinking.
Yeah,
before thinking makes him actually...
Pre-thought, isn't it?
Pre-thought, yes.
Makes him much less vulnerable.
But it's that sort of like, you're walking down the street, and instead of like looking at people and labeling them, actually look and notice like someone with, has got a stick in their hand, who's not the, like Michael Levin walking down the street with a big stick in his hand, and he wouldn't be the first person to guess he's dangerous. But if you look, you'd say, oh, you would see that and know, and like just know right away, like this is not where I want to be, as opposed to saying, oh, that kind of person is safe, because that's what I always think of people like that.
Actually, someone who's about to attack you, I can remember this, I should have seen the stiffness. It had nothing to do with the visible weapon, but I should have seen the dual tension and fear in this 18-year-old kid who was about to do something.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't pay attention to that, to sensing it.
Yeah.
What happened?
These two kids jumped in. I was down on the sidewalk. One of them has a little penknife getting right up to my throat, and it says, I'm going to kill you. But it happened so suddenly that I didn't have any fear. Actually, I hadn't had time to come up, and I saw how frightened they were.
Oh.
And I said, here's my wallet, take it. It's right here, take it. So that deflected them onto the wallet.
Oh, you never told me that story. You're braver than I thought.
But if I had been more alert, I would have seen. I would have seen ahead of time that that something was cooking, because they were up to something.
Yeah.
They were. Their fear was visible.
So the next one's right speech, and I think this one's really quite easy to understand. It's really about paying attention to the things we say, and as Sun-Song talks about, a right speech appears by, if you be careful what you say, use speech in a clear, compassionate way. Speech comes from thought. So the first thing is the thought moves, and then the tongue moves. If you drop your opinions and conditions, then right speech appears by itself. So, for me, I think I'm really starting to pay more attention to how I use language and a lot of things I say that aren't really that necessary. So I think it's about, actually, it can be about reducing speech. And actually there's some, I don't know if it's one of these books, but they talk about periods of silence in meditation, or having no talking. And often if you do a long retreat, there'll be periods where there's no talking. And that is very informative when you can't really say a lot of things you normally would, and then you realize a lot of things you say are really not all that necessary. So it's not to get uptight, but it's actually just to notice. And I think there's a lot of information that comes to us when we're able to actually pay attention to how we speak and what we talk about. So obviously on many levels it's about not lying or not gossiping or not saying bad things about people or slandering. Those are all
those are called the 10 virtuous actions.
Yes, indeedy. I've been studying all of them, but we're not going there. Thank you, Michael. You slipped in. Okay, the next one, right action. Traditionally, we talk about the five precepts on right action, and this is from a monastic point of view, and this is how this was included originally. Not killing, lying, stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, and not using intoxicants. And he talks about to produce heedlessness. So basically using intoxicants, alcohol, drugs, whatever, that you would lose your mindfulness. Trungpa Rinpoche doesn't take it from that point of view, as we might know. He talks about right discipline is a giving up process which brings us into complete simplicity. He talks about simplifying your life and giving. There's the ego.
But even with Trungpa Rinpoche, because we do, Rinpoche did introduce the practice of the taking the five commitments, mm-hmm. precepts daily, and it depends on who's giving them to you. But what it really means is not to be abusive if you have an intoxicant. Abusive means to produce heedlessness. They're completely in synchronization mm-hmm. there.
Right.
He didn't say not you can't drink, but rather the idea is you want to maintain mindfulness, and
right.
you begin to realize mindfulness is the most precious thing you have. So when you start getting sloppy, and you lose your awareness. You're not really actually engaged in awareness when you just start throwing yourself around.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that means.
Right. So you can see the general feeling here is a sense of holding properly. That could be another way of thinking mm-hmm. of it. You know, like you're holding your speech properly, you're holding your body in your mind. So the next one is right livelihood. So that's pretty much just paying attention to what you do in your life in terms of earning money and being aware of things that hurt the earth or hurt other people or what provides benefit. So paying attention to that. Sunsanim talks about our inside work is keeping a clear mind. Outside work is earning money or functioning in the world. That cause and effect are operating there. So, okay, the next one is right effort. And this is spoken of in terms of, you could say, sticking to your meditation practice. No matter what the conditions, no matter how you feel, you just keep doing your practice, and there's a commitment to it. And Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it. It's interesting. He called it right energy, right endurance, right exertion. So it's similar, but it's kind of slightly different. And he talks about needing gaps in our discursive thinking to experience right effort. And this natural openness is right effort, which is interesting because we think about like working so hard to come back to the space. But he reverses that and says that the space is open to you. Oh, that's down below. Oh, that openness.
Uphill at first.
Yeah.
It can involve a lot of application of effort when you realize how much your mind wanders everywhere. I'm a living example of how mind wanders anytime, just, instantly. Gone. But uphill at first, but painful, then at some point practice becomes a delight because as you begin to sense a greater sense of just simply being present, you begin to realize that's where you find yourself at ease. You're not going anywhere else, and you begin to realize that's very positive. It's nice to be here.
So that line actually came from Michael Levin. Yes, it did. I wrote it down after you listened to me today. Uphill at first, that's what you said. The
Michael
practice.
Fagan just said it. Yeah.
And he did. Yeah, but he said it because it's on my paper.
I'm reading it.
He's reading it. It's on it. But anyway, it's all true. It's all true. The next one's right mindfulness. And if you wake up right now, you get happiness. If you follow your desire, anger, and ignorance, you get suffering. So that's pretty direct. Trungpa Rinpoche says, right mindfulness does not simply mean being aware. There is more spaciousness in right mindfulness than in right effort. Space is open to you. We always have a choice in the present moment. So
what
does this make sense?
Space is open to you?
There's always the possibility of space. There's always spaciousness. We just, so the mindfulness, sometimes we think when we talk about mindfulness that it's almost concentration or there's a tightening there because you're kind of forcing yourself back, you know. But it's really actually you're just allowing there to be space around the thoughts. That's another way of looking at it. The openness is
relaxing
there all the time.
Mind.
Relaxing.
With space, kind of?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And the last one is right meditation. From moment to moment, keeping a not moving mind. Oh, this is very funny. So the Zen Center in Providence, they had, it sounded like it might have been in the beginning years, they had an apartment within a apartment building, and a rock and roll band moved in downstairs right below them. That was so funny in the book. And so the students were all upset because they're trying to have these really good meditations, and all they hear is this rock and roll band music. And so this is what their teacher says. Finding quiet in the quiet is not true quiet. Quiet in the noisy is true quiet. Isn't that perfect? And he says, how do you keep your mind right now? That makes your life. If your mind is clear, the whole universe is clear. So I thought that was good. And it's good, too. You know, sometimes we have other distractions and things going on here in the room next door. And it's not really a problem. And it's, first you think that's going to be irritating to your mindfulness and your meditation is going to be thrown off. But that's the point, is actually whatever happens in your life, you bring it into your practice. That's really good training. So Trungpa Rinpoche calls this right samadhi, and these cushions that you're sitting on here are from samadhi cushions. So that word means meditation. So there you go. Or right absorption. So relating with the space of a situation, being completely involved in a non-dualistic way. So those are the eight. That's the Eightfold Path. I think it requires more contemplation. Yes.
What does samadhi mean again?
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness.
Meditation.
Well, actually,
meditation
has different
Gong.
Aspects that you would talk about. Mm-hmm. When we talk about samadhi, we're talking about absorption in the general sense. In other words, you are really present. When you have complete samadhi, you are completely present. You're not; your mind is not wandering anywhere. Not only are you simply attentive to the details, which is more of a mindful thing, being attentive to the present, but you're actually much more steeped in the present, more fully engaged.
And that type of experience comes if you do a longer meditation period, generally. I mean, it's very
that's
hard
why
to
we,
come
that's
to
why
that.
Inviting you to come on Saturday.
Right. It's very...
No pressure.
Right, no pressure. But it,
come for 5 minutes and run out the door.
Okay.
That's as much courage as Roberta.
I'm going to give you this, Roberta, to take home and read. And there's a wonderful section in here that just applies to you.
Roberta.
Just for Roberta.
No one else's mind works like this. Just Roberta.
Yes.
I don't read very well.
Yes, you will. Let's see if I can find it. Well, I'll find it. Oh, yes. So this is about a student. Okay, so We had one student several years ago who did a whole 90-day meditation retreat at the Providence Zen Center lying on his back because of chronic back and leg problems. While everyone else was facing the wall, he was facing the ceiling. He was able to sit up long enough to do formal meals and a few chants. He was also able to sit up for the length of an interview with the teacher. But for the rest of the day, he only lay down. An eminent teacher said, "When walking, standing, sitting, lying down, speaking, being silent, moving, being still, at all times, in all places, without interruption, what is this?" These are very important words. True meditation practice is certainly not dependent on being able to maintain some formal sitting posture for great lengths of time. It means just keeping a great question, only, what am I? That's for you.
Thank you.
Okay. No excuses. Bring your cushion. You can lie on the floor. How's that?
Okay.
Okay. So any final comments or questions or comments or anything else? Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.